single-letter sounds, but for whole syllables or more. The idea that each sign might represent one sound, and that just 26 of those signs were all you needed to write every conceivable word, was a wholly new invention, one that can only have been made by people who did a lot of writing. Not just sacred texts and songs, but all sorts of letters, contracts, and receipts. These inventors were merchants, men who travelled far and wide across the seas, bartering and trading in every land. They lived quite near the Jews, in the ports of Tyre and Sidon, cities much larger and more powerful than Jerusalem, and quite as noisy and bustling as Babylon. And, in fact, their language and their religion were not unlike those of the peoples of Mesopotamia, although they didn't share their love of war. The Phoenicians, for this was the name of the people of Tyre and Sidon, made their conquests by other means. They sailed across the seas to unknown shores, where they landed and set up trading posts. The wild tribes living there brought them furs and precious stones in exchange for tools, cooking pots, and coloured cloth. For Phoenician craftsmanship was known throughout the world. Indeed, their artisans had even helped in the construction of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. Most popular of all their goods was their dyed cloth, especially the purple, which they sold throughout the world. Many Phoenicians stayed in their trading posts on foreign shores and built towns. Everywhere they went, they were welcomed, in Africa, Spain, and in southern Italy, on account of the beautiful things they brought. Nor did they ever feel cut off from home, because they could write letters to their friends in Tyre and Sidon, using the wonderfully simple script they had invented, which we still use today. It's true. Take this B, for example. It is almost identical to the one used by the ancient Phoenicians 3,000 years ago, when they wrote home from distant shores, sending news to their families in those noisy, bustling harbour towns. Now you know this, you'll be sure not to forget the Phoenicians. Chapter 7. Heroes and Their Weapons. Here are some lines to be chanted aloud while tapping their rhythm. Lines that were used by the poets of Greece in their stories of warfare, telling the contests of gods and of heroes in earlier ages. Verses like this, with 6 beats to each line, were called hexameters by the Greeks. The rhythm suits the Greek language, but it sounds a little unnatural in English. You will have heard of the war that arose when Paris the Trojan sided with Venus and gave her the apple of gold in the contest. How, as reward, she helped him to seize the beautiful Helen, wife of the king of the Greeks, Menelaus, the caller in battle. How an army of Greeks laid siege to the city of Troy to regain her, with Agamemnon and Nestor the sage, Achilles and Ajax, and countless heroes who fought in that war with the sons of King Priam, Paris and Hector, for 10 long summers and winters before the city at last was conquered and razed to the ground by the victors. Do you also remember the tale of the wily Odysseus? How returning from Troy he experienced the strangest adventures, till at last on miraculous ships he returned to his homeland, to the wife who awaited her lord all the years of his absence. Verses like these were chanted at feasts by Greek minstrels as they played their lyres. Later they were written down, and people came to believe that one poet, called Homer, had composed them all. They are read to this day, and you too can enjoy them, for they are as fresh and vivid as ever, full of beauty and wisdom. Now wait a minute, you're going to say. These are stories, not history. What I want to know is, when and how did these events take place? A German businessman called Schliemann asked himself that same question more than 100 years ago. He read Homer over and over again, and longed to see all the beautiful places described by the poet. If only he could hold in his hands, just once, the wonderful weapons with which these heroes fought. And one day he did, for it turned out that all of it was true. Not in every detail, of course. The heroes named in the songs were no more real than the giants and witches in fairy tales. But the world that Homer describes, the drinking cups, the weapons, the buildings and the ships, The princes who were at the same time shepherds and the heroes who were also sea raiders were not inventions. When Schliemann told people this, they laughed at him. But he didn't give up. He just kept putting money aside so that one day he could go to Greece and see for himself. And when he had finally raised enough money, he hired laborers and set about digging in search of all the cities mentioned in Homer. At Mycenae he discovered palaces and the tombs of kings, armor and shields, just as the Homeric songs had described them. And he found Troy, too, and dug there. And it turned out that it really had been destroyed by fire. But in all those tombs and palaces there wasn't one inscription, so that for a long time no one could put a date to them until, one day, quite by chance, a ring was found in Mycenae that didn't come from there. On it, in hieroglyphs, was the name of an Egyptian king who had lived around 1400 BC and had been the predecessor of Akhenaten, the great reformer. Now, at that time, there was living in Greece and on the many neighboring islands and shores a warlike people who had amassed great treasures. Greece was not so much a kingdom as a collection of small fortified cities, each with its own palace and king. The people were mostly seafarers, like the Phoenicians, only they traded less and fought more. They were often at war with one another, but on occasion would gang together to plunder other shores. And as their fortunes grew bigger, they grew bolder. And not just bolder, but braver, because to be a sea raider takes courage as well as cunning. So sea raiding was a task which fell to the nobility. The rest of the population were simple peasants and shepherds. Now, unlike the Egyptians, the Babylonians, and the Assyrians, these noblemen weren't interested in preserving the ways of their ancestors. Their many raids and battles with foreign peoples had opened their eyes to new ideas and taught them to relish variety and change. And it was at this point, and in this part of the world, that history began to progress at a much greater speed, because people no longer believed that the old ways were best. From now on, things were constantly changing. And this is why, nowadays, when we find even a fragment of pottery in Greece or anywhere else in Europe, we can say, "This dates from roughly this or that period," because 100 years later a pot like that would have gone out of fashion and nobody would have wanted it. It is now thought that all the beautiful things that Schliemann found in his excavations of Greek cities, the fine vessels and daggers decorated with hunting scenes, the golden shields and helmets, the jewellery, and even the colourful paintings on the walls of the halls, were not invented there. They were first made not in Greece or in Troy, but on an island nearby. This island is called Crete. There, at the time of King Hammurabi, do you remember when that was? The Cretans had already built splendid royal palaces with innumerable rooms, staircases running up and down in all directions, great pillars, courtyards, corridors, and cellars, a veritable labyrinth. Speaking of labyrinths, have you ever heard the story of the evil Minotaur, half man, half bull, who lived in a labyrinth and made the Greeks send him 7 youths and 7 maidens each year as human sacrifices? Do you know where that was? It was in Crete. So there may be some truth in the story. Cretan kings may once have ruled over Greek cities, and those Greeks may have had to send them tribute. In any event, these Cretans were clearly a remarkable people, even if we still don't know much about them. You only have to look at the paintings on the walls of their palaces to see that they are unlike any made at the same time in Egypt or in Babylon. If you remember, the Egyptian pictures were very beautiful, but rather severe and stiff, a bit like their priests. This was not the case in Crete. What mattered most to them was to catch animals or people in rapid motion, hounds chasing wild boar and people leaping over bulls. Nothing was too hard for them to paint. The kings of the Greek cities clearly learnt a great deal from them. But by 1200 BC, this time of splendour was over. For it was at around that time, some 200 years before the reign of King Solomon, that new tribes came down from the north. Whether they were related to the former builders of Mycenae, nobody knows for sure, but it is likely. In any event, they drove out the kings and installed themselves in their place. Meanwhile, Crete had been destroyed. But the memory of its magnificence lived on in the minds of the invaders, even when they founded new cities and built their own shrines. And as the centuries went by, the tales of the kings of ancient Mycenae became confused with those of their own battles and conquests, until they became part of their own history. These newcomers were the Greeks, and the myths and songs sung in the courts of their nobles were the very same Homeric poems with which this chapter began. It is worth remembering that they were composed shortly before 800 BC. When the Greeks came to Greece, they were not yet Greeks. Does that sound strange? Yet it is true, for the fact is that when the tribes from the north first invaded the lands they were to occupy, they weren't yet a unified people. They spoke different dialects and were obedient to different chieftains. They were tribes, rather like the Sioux or the Mohicans you read about in stories of the Wild West, and had names such as the Dorians, Ionians, and Aeolians. Like the American Indians, they were warlike and brave, but in other ways they were quite different. The Native Americans were familiar with iron, while the people of Mycenae and Crete, just as the songs of Homer tell us, had weapons made of bronze. And so these tribes arrived with their wives and their children. The Dorians pushed furthest, right down into the southernmost tip of Greece, which looks like a maple leaf and is called the Peloponnese. There they subdued the inhabitants and set them to work in the fields. They themselves founded a city where they lived and called it Sparta. The Ionians, who arrived after the Dorians, found there was not enough room for them all in Greece. Many of them settled above the maple leaf, to the north of its stalk, on a peninsula called Attica. They made their homes by the sea and planted vines, cereals, and olive trees. And they too founded a city, which they dedicated to the goddess Athena, she who, in the Homeric songs, so often came to the rescue of Ulysses the sailor. That city is Athens. Like all the members of the Ionian tribe, the Athenians were great seafarers, and in due course they took possession of a number of small islands, known since that time as the Ionian Islands. Later, they went even further and founded cities far across the sea, away from Greece, along the fertile coast of Asia Minor, with its many sheltering bays. No sooner did the Phoenicians hear of these cities than they sailed there to trade. And the Greeks will have sold them olive oil and cereals, as well as silver and other metals found in those regions. But they soon learnt so much from the Phoenicians that they too sailed onwards to distant shores, where they founded their own outposts, or colonies as we call them, and the Phoenicians passed on to them their wonderful way of writing using letters. You shall see what use they made of it. Chapter 8. An Unequal Struggle. Something very strange happened between 550 and 500 BC. I don't really understand it myself, but perhaps that's what makes it so interesting. In the high mountain chain that runs north of Mesopotamia, a wild mountain tribe had long been living. They had a beautiful religion. They worshipped light and the sun and believed it to be in a state of constant warfare with the dark, that is, with the dark powers of evil. These mountain people were the Persians. For hundreds of years they had been dominated, first by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians. One day they had had enough. Their ruler was a man of exceptional courage and intelligence called Cyrus, who was no longer prepared to put up with the oppression of his people. He led his band of horsemen down onto the plain of Babylon. The Babylonians looked down from their mighty ramparts and laughed at the little band of warriors that dared attack their city. Yet, under Cyrus's leadership, they succeeded, through courage and guile. And so Cyrus became lord of that great realm. His first act was to free all the peoples held in captivity by the Babylonians. Among them were the Jews, who went home to Jerusalem. That was, as you remember, in 538 BC. Not content with his great kingdom, however, Cyrus marched on to conquer Egypt, only to die on the way. But his son, Cambyses, succeeded. Egypt fell and the pharaoh was deposed. That was the end of the Egyptian empire, which had lasted almost 3,000 years. And with its end, this little Persian tribe became master of nearly all the known world. But only nearly. They hadn't yet swallowed up Greece. That was still to come. It came after the death of Cambyses, during the reign of a great king named Darius. He governed the vast Persian Empire, which now stretched from Egypt to the frontiers of India, in such a way that nothing happened anywhere that he himself had not decreed. He built roads so that his orders might be carried without delay to the furthest parts of his kingdom. And even his highest officials, the satraps, were spied on by informers known as the king's eyes and ears. Darius now began to extend his empire out into Asia Minor, along whose coasts lay the cities of the Ionian Greeks. Now the Greeks were not used to being part of a great empire, with a ruler who sent orders from God knows where in the heart of Asia, expecting instant obedience. Many of the people who lived in the Greek colonies were rich merchants, used to running their own affairs and making their own decisions about the administration of their cities, jointly and independently. They had no wish to be ruled by a Persian king, nor would they pay him tribute. So they rebelled and threw out the Persian governors. In this they were supported by the Greeks in the motherland, the original founders of the colonies, and in particular by the Athenians, who sent them ships. Never before had the king of Persia, the king of kings, for that was his title, been so insulted. That this insignificant tribe, these nobodies, should dare to challenge him, the ruler of the world. He dealt with the Ionian cities in Asia Minor in less than no time, but he wasn't finished yet. He was furious with the Athenians for meddling in his affairs. With the aim of destroying Athens and conquering Greece, he equipped a large fleet, but his ships were caught in a violent storm, dashed against the cliffs and sunk. At this, his anger knew no bounds. The story goes that he appointed a slave to call out 3 times at every meal, "Sire, remember the Athenians." So great was his fury. He then sent his son-in-law with a new and mighty fleet to sail against Athens. They conquered many islands on their way and destroyed a lot of cities. They finally dropped anchor not far from Athens at a place called Marathon. There the whole great Persian army disembarked, ready to march on Athens. It is said that they numbered 70,000 men, as many as the entire population of Athens. With roughly 10,000 soldiers, the Athenian army was outnumbered 7-1. Their fate was surely sealed. But not quite. For the Athenians had a general named Miltiades, a brave and able man who had lived for many years among the Persians and knew their fighting tactics. Added to which, the Athenians all knew what was at stake, their freedom and their lives, and those of their wives and children. So there at Marathon they formed ranks and fell upon the startled Persians, and they were victorious. The Persians suffered heavy losses. Those remaining took to their ships and fled. Such a victory, and against such odds. Others in his place might have thought of nothing but celebration, but Miltiades was shrewd as well as brave. He had noted that instead of sailing back the way they had come, the Persian ships had turned towards Athens, which lay undefended and open to attack. But, as luck would have it, the distance from Marathon to Athens was greater by sea than by land, for ships had to negotiate a long spit of land easily crossed on foot. This Miltiades did. He sent a messenger ahead, who was to run as fast as he could to warn the Athenians. This was the famous Marathon run, after which we call our race. Famous because the messenger ran so far and so fast that all he could do was deliver his message before he fell down dead. Meanwhile, Miltiades and his army had taken the same route, marching in tremendous haste. This was just as well, for no sooner had they reached the harbour at Athens than the Persian fleet appeared over the horizon. But there was no more fighting. At the sight of their heroic enemy, the disheartened Persians turned tail and sailed for home. And not just Athens, but the whole of Greece was saved. This was 490 BC. How the great Darius, king of kings, must have cursed when he learned of the defeat at Marathon. But at the time there was little he could do about Greece, for a revolt had broken out in Egypt which had to be suppressed. He died soon after, leaving his son and successor, Xerxes, to take revenge on Greece once and for all. Xerxes, a hard, ambitious man, needed no urging. He assembled an army from among all the subject peoples of his empire. dressed in their traditional costumes, with their weapons, their bows and arrows, shields and swords, lances, war chariots and slings. They were a vast, swirling multitude, said by some to number more than 1,000,000 men. What hope had the Greeks in the face of such a host? This time Xerxes himself took command. But when the Persians tried to cross the narrow neck of sea which separates Asia Minor from today's Istanbul, on a bridge made of boats, rough waves tore the bridge apart. In his fury, Xerxes had the waves lashed with chains. But I doubt if the sea took any notice. One part of this gigantic army attacked Greece by sea, while another part marched overland. In northern Greece, a small army of Spartans, who had made an alliance with the Athenians, tried to block the Persian advance in a narrow pass called Thermopylae. The Persians called on the Spartans to throw down their weapons. "Come and get them yourselves," was the reply. "We've enough arrows here to blot out the sun," threatened the Persians. "So much the better," cried the Spartans. "Then we'll fight in the shade." But a treacherous Greek showed the Persians a way over the mountains, and the Spartan army was surrounded and trapped. All 300 Spartans and 700 of their allies were killed in the battle. But not one of them tried to run away, for that was their law. Later, a Greek poet wrote these words in their memory. "Go tell the Spartans, thou who passest by, that here, obedient to their laws, we lie." Now, the Athenians had not been idle since their great victory at Marathon, and they had a new leader called Themistocles, an astute and far-sighted man who repeatedly warned his fellow citizens that a miracle like Marathon could only happen once, and that if Athens were to continue to hold out against the Persians, it must have a fleet. So a fleet was built. Themistocles had the whole of Athens evacuated, not that the population can have been very large in those days, and sent to the little island of Salamis, nearby. The Athenian fleet then positioned itself by this island. When the Persian land army arrived and found Athens abandoned, they set fire to the city and razed it to the ground, while the Athenians on their island remained unharmed as they watched their burning city from afar. But now the Persian fleet appeared and threatened to surround Salamis. The allies panicked, and were all for taking to their ships and leaving the Athenians to their fate. At this moment, Themistocles demonstrated his extraordinary ingenuity and daring. Having finally succeeded in persuading the allies not to leave, he secretly sent a messenger to Xerxes, saying, "Make haste and attack, or the Athenians' allies will escape you." Xerxes, who must have heard from his spies that the allies were set on leaving, fell for it. The next morning he attacked with his many small and nimble warships, and he lost. The Greek ships were larger and less easy to maneuver, but once again they were fighting desperately for their freedom. Not only that, but their victory 10 years earlier at Marathon had inspired them with confidence. From a vantage point, Xerxes was forced to look on while his smaller, lighter galleys were rammed and sunk by the Greeks' heavy ships. Aghast, he ordered the retreat. And so, for the second time, the Athenians were victorious, and against an even greater army than before. This was in 480 BC. Shortly afterwards, in 479 BC, the Persian land army was also defeated by the combined forces of the Greeks and their allies, near Plataea. After this, the Persians never again dared attack the Greeks. And this is very interesting, because it wasn't as if the Persians were weaker or more stupid than the Greeks. Far from it. But, as I said before, the Greeks were different. For, whereas the great empires of the East bound themselves so tightly to the traditions and teachings of their ancestors that they could scarcely move, the Greeks, and the Athenians in particular, did the opposite. Almost every year they came up with something new. Everything was always changing. The same went for their leaders. Miltiades and Themistocles, the great heroes of the Persian Wars, learnt this to their cost. One moment it was high praise, honours, and monuments to their achievements, the next it was accusations, slander, and exile. This was not the best feature of the Athenians, yet it was part of their nature, always trying out new ideas, never satisfied, never at rest. Which explains why, during the 100 years that followed the Persian Wars, more went on in the minds of the people of the little city of Athens than in 1,000 years in all the great empires of the East. The ideas, the painting, sculpture and architecture, the plays and poetry, the inventions and experiments, the discussions and arguments which the young brought to the marketplaces and the old to their council chambers, still continue to concern us today. It is strange that it should be so, and yet it's true. And what would it have been like if the Persians had won at Marathon, or at Salamis 10 years later? That I cannot say. Chapter 9. Two Small Cities in One Small Land. I said earlier that Greece, when set against the Persian Empire, was no more than a small peninsula, dotted here and there with little cities of busy merchants, a country of barren mountain ranges and stony fields, able to sustain only a handful of people. And also, as you may remember, that the Greeks belonged to a number of tribes, the most important of them being the Dorians in the south, and the Ionians and the Aeolians in the north. These tribes differed little from one another, either in appearance or in language. They spoke different dialects, which they could all understand if they chose, but they very rarely did, for, as is often the case, these close-related neighbouring tribes were unable to get on with one another. They spent all their time exchanging insults and ridicule, when actually they were jealous of each other. For Greece had no one king or administration in common. Instead, each city was a kingdom in itself. But one thing united the Greeks, their religion and their sport. And I say one thing because, strangely enough, sport and religion weren't two separate things. They were closely connected. For instance, in honour of Zeus, the father of the gods, great sporting contests were held every 4 years in his sanctuary at Olympia. As well as large temples, there was a stadium at Olympia, and all the Greeks, the Dorians, Ionians, Spartans, and Athenians, came there to show how well they could run, throw the discus and the javelin, fight hand to hand and race chariots. To be victorious at Olympia was the greatest honour in a man's life. The prize was no more than a simple garland made from sprigs of wild olive, but what fame for the winners! The greatest poets sang their praises, the greatest sculptors carved their statues to stand forever in Olympia. They were shown in their chariots, throwing the discus or rubbing oil into their bodies before the fight. Victory statues like these can still be seen today. There may even be one in your local museum. Since the Olympic Games took place once every 4 years, and were attended by all the Greeks, they provided everyone with a convenient way to measure time. This was gradually adopted throughout Greece. Just as we say B.C., meaning before the birth of Christ, or A.D., for after the birth of Christ, Anno Domini, which means the year of our Lord in Latin, the Greeks would say, at the time of this or that Olympiad. The first Olympiad was in 776 B.C. Can you work out when the 10th would have been? But don't forget, they only happened every 4 years. But it wasn't only the Olympic Games that brought all the Greeks together. There was another sanctuary which they all held sacred. This one was at Delphi, and belonged to the sun god Apollo, and there was something most peculiar about it. As sometimes happens in volcanic regions, there was a fissure in the ground from which vapour issued. If anyone inhaled it, it literally clouded their mind. It was as if they were drunk or delirious, and nothing they said made any sense. The very meaninglessness of these utterances seemed deeply mysterious to the Greeks, who said that the god himself speaks through a mortal mouth. So they had a priestess, whom they called Pythia, sit over the fissure on a three-legged stool, while other priests interpreted her babble as predictions of the future. The shrine was known as the Delphic Oracle, and at difficult moments of their lives, Greeks from everywhere made pilgrimages to Delphi to consult the god Apollo. The answer they received was often far from clear, and could be understood in a variety of ways. And in fact, we still say that a vague or enigmatic answer is oracular. Let us now take a closer look at two of Greece's most important cities, Sparta and Athens. We already know something about the Spartans. They were Dorians who, when they arrived in Greece in around 1100 BC, enslaved the former inhabitants and put them to work on the land. But the slaves outnumbered their masters, and the danger of rebellion meant that the Spartans had to be constantly on the alert, lest they find themselves homeless again. They only had one aim in life, to be fighting fit, ready to crush any uprising by their slaves, and to protect themselves from the surrounding peoples still at liberty. And they really did think of nothing else. Their lawgiver, Lycurgus, had already seen to that. A Spartan baby that appeared weak and unlikely to grow up to be a warrior was killed at birth. A strong infant had to be made stronger. From a very young age he must train from dawn till dusk, learn to endure pain, hunger, and cold, must eat poorly and be denied all pleasure. Boys were beaten just to harden them to pain. A harsh upbringing is still called Spartan today, and as you know, it worked. At Thermopylae in 480 BC, in obedience to their law, the Spartans allowed themselves to be massacred by the Persians. Knowing how to die like that isn't easy. But knowing how to live is, perhaps, even harder. And this is what the Athenians aimed to do. They weren't looking for an easy, comfortable life, but one which had meaning. A life of which something remained after one's death. Something of benefit to those who came after. You shall see how they succeeded. Had they not lived in fear of their own slaves, the Spartans might never have become so warlike and brave. Athenians had fewer reasons to be afraid, and they didn't live under the same pressures. Things were different for them, even though, as in Sparta, the nobles who once ruled Athens imposed harsh laws, drawn up by an Athenian named Draco. These laws were so strict that people still speak of draconian severity. But the people of Athens, who had roamed the seas in their ships and had heard and seen so many different things, did not consent to this for long. It was, in fact, a nobleman who had the wisdom to try to give the little state a new system of government. His name was Solon, and the laws he introduced in 594 BC, at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, were named after him. They stated that the people, that is, the city's inhabitants, should decide the city's affairs themselves. They should assemble in the marketplace of Athens and vote. The majority should decide, and should elect a council of experts to put those decisions into effect. This sort of government is called democracy, or the rule of the people in Greek. This didn't mean that everyone who lived in Athens was entitled to vote in the assembly. Citizenship depended on wealth and influence, and many people, including women and slaves, played no part in government. But many Athenians could at least have their say, and so they took an interest in how their city was run. Polis is Greek for city, politics the affairs of a city. For a while, individual noblemen curried favour with the people to win their votes, and then seized power. Rulers like these were called tyrants, but the people soon expelled them and took better care next time to ensure that it was they themselves who really governed. I have already told you about the wayward nature of the Athenians, and it was this, together with a real fear of losing their freedom once again, which led them to banish any politician who showed signs of becoming too popular, lest he seize power for himself and rule as a tyrant. The same free people of Athens who defeated the Persians later treated Miltiades and Themistocles with just such ingratitude. But there was one politician who avoided this fate. His name was Pericles. When he spoke in the assembly, the Athenians always believed that it was they who had made the decisions, whereas in fact it was Pericles who had made up his mind long before. This wasn't because he held any special office or had any particular power. He was simply the wisest and the most intelligent. And so he gradually worked his way up until, by 444 BC, a number as beautiful as the time it represents, he was, in effect, the city's sole ruler. His chief concern was that Athens should maintain its power at sea, and this he achieved through alliances with other Ionian cities who paid Athens for its protection. In this way, the Athenians grew rich and could at last afford to make use of their great gifts. And now I can hear you asking, but what exactly did they do that was so great? And I can only say, everything. But two things interested them most. And these were truth and beauty. Their assemblies had taught the Athenians how to discuss all matters openly, with arguments for and against. This was good training in learning how to think. Soon they were using arguments and counter-arguments, not just when they were debating everyday matters like whether or not to increase taxation, but in discussions about the whole of nature. The Ionians in the colonial outposts may have been ahead of them here, for they had already reflected on what the world was actually made of, and what might be the cause of all events and experiences. This sort of reflection is what we call philosophy. In Athens, however, their reflecting, or philosophizing, went much further. They also wanted to know how people should act, what was good and what was evil, and what was just and what was unjust. They wanted to find an explanation for human existence and discover the essence of all things. Of course, not everyone agreed on matters as complex as these. There were various theories and opinions that were argued back and forth, just as in the People's Assembly. And since that time, the sort of reflection and reasoned argument we call philosophy has never stopped. But the Athenians didn't only pace up and down their porticos and sports fields talking about things like the essence of life and how to recognize it and where it came from. They didn't just picture the world in a new way in their minds. They saw it with new eyes. When you look at the works of Greek artists and see how fresh and simple and beautiful they are, it is as if their creators were seeing the world for the first time. We spoke of the statues of Olympic champions earlier. They show fine human beings, not posed, but looking as if the position they are shown in is the most natural one in the world. And it is because they seem so natural that they are so beautiful. The Greeks portrayed their gods with the same beauty and humanity. The most famous sculptor of such statues was Phidias. He did not create mysterious and supernatural images like the colossal statues in Egyptian temples. Although some of his temple statues were large and splendid and made of precious materials like ivory and gold, their beauty was never insipid, and they had a noble and natural grace which must have inspired confidence in the gods they represented. And the same can be said for Athenian paintings and buildings. But nothing remains of the pictures they painted on the walls of their halls and assembly rooms. All we have are little paintings on pottery, on vases and urns. Their loveliness tells us what we have lost. However, the temples are still standing, even in Athens. And best of all, the citadel of Athens is still there, the Acropolis, where new sanctuaries made of marble were erected in the time of Pericles, because the old ones had been burnt and destroyed by the Persians while the Athenians watched from the island of Salamis. The Acropolis still contains the most beautiful buildings we know, not the grandest or the most splendid, simply the most beautiful. Every detail is so clear and so simple that one cannot imagine it otherwise. All the forms which the Greeks employed in these buildings were to be used again and again in architecture. You will find Greek columns, of which there are several kinds, in almost every city of the world, once you have learned to recognize them. But none of them is as beautiful as those on the Acropolis, where they are used not for show and decoration, but for the purpose for which they were invented, as elegant supports for the roof. Both wisdom of thought and beauty of form were to be united by the Athenians in a third art, the art of poetry. And here, too, they invented something new, the theatre. Their theatre, like their sport, was also once bound up with their religion, with festivals held in honour of their god Dionysus, also known as Bacchus. On his feast day a performance was held which could last all day. It took place in the open air, and the actors wore huge masks and high heels so that they could be easily seen from a distance. We still have plays which they performed. Some are serious, grand, and solemn. They are called tragedies. But there were other ones that were very sharp, witty, and lively, which made fun of certain Athenian citizens. These are called comedies. I could tell you lots more about the Athenians, about their historians and their doctors, their singers, their thinkers, and their artists. But I think it would be better for you to find out about them yourself one day. Then you'll see that I haven't exaggerated. Chapter 10. The Enlightened One and His Land. And now let us go to the opposite end of the world, to India and then to China, so that we can find out what was going on in these vast lands at the time of the Persian Wars. Like Mesopotamia, India also had a very ancient civilization. and at about the same time as the Sumerians were holding sway at Ur, that is, around 2500 BC, there was a mighty city in the valley of the Indus. The Indus is a great river which flows through what is Pakistan today. It had well-drained streets, canals, granaries, and workshops, and was called Mohenjo-Daro, and until its discovery in the 1920s, nobody had even dreamt of its existence. When it was excavated, things came to light that were as remarkable as any found in the rubble mounds at Ur. Although we know almost nothing about the people who built Mohenjo-Daro, we do know that different people arrived much later, and that they are ancestors of the people who inhabit northern India and Pakistan today. These people spoke a language similar not only to those spoken by the Persians and Greeks, but also to those of the Romans and the Teutons. An example of this is the word for father. In ancient Indian, it was pitar. The Greek is pater, the Latin pater. Since both Indians and Europeans speak these languages, they are known as the Indo-European family of languages. Whether the fact that the languages are similar means that the people who speak them are actually distant relatives, we don't yet know for sure. But in any event, the people who spoke an Indo-European language invaded India much as the Dorians invaded Greece, and may have enslaved the native population just as they did. In time, most of the continent was subdued by the descendants of these invaders, who, like the Spartans, maintained a distance between themselves and the peoples they had conquered. Traces of this division persist today in what is known as the caste system. In it, professions or occupations are strictly separated from each other. Men who were warriors had to remain warriors, and their sons had to be warriors too, because they belonged to the warrior caste. Other castes were similarly closed, like those of farmers and craftsmen. A farmer could never become a craftsman, or a craftsman a farmer, nor could their sons. Someone who was a member of one caste couldn't marry a girl from another, or even share a meal with a member of another caste. At the top were the priests, or Brahmins, even higher than the warriors. Their task was to perform sacrifices to the gods and look after the temples. And, as in Egypt, they were in charge of sacred knowledge. They had to learn all the chants and prayers off by heart, so that they were preserved and handed down unchanged. They did this for more than 1,000 years, until the texts were finally written down. A tiny part of the population was excluded from any caste. They were pariahs, people who were given the dirtiest and most unpleasant tasks. Not even members of the lowest castes could associate with them. Their very touch was thought to be defiling. So they became known as the untouchables. They weren't allowed to fetch water from the streams that other Indians used, and had to make sure that their shadow never touched another person, because even that was thought to be defiling. People can be very cruel. But it would be wrong to say that the Indians were a cruel people. On the contrary, their priests were serious and profound thinkers, who often withdrew into the forest to meditate, alone and undisturbed, on the most difficult questions. They meditated on their many fierce gods, and on Brahma, the sublime, the highest divinity of all. They seemed to sense the breath of this one supreme being throughout the natural world, in gods as well as men, and in every animal and plant. They felt him active in all things, in the shining of the sun and in the sprouting of crops, in growing and in dying. He was everywhere, just as a little salt dropped in water makes all the water salty, down to the last drop. In all the variety of nature, in all her cycles and transformations, we only see the surface. A soul may inhabit the body of a man, and after his death that of a tiger or a cobra or any other living creature. The cycle will only end when that soul has become so pure that it can at last become one with the Supreme Being. For the divine breath of Brahma is the essence of all things. To help their pupils understand this, Indian priests had a lovely formula which you may turn over in your mind. All they said was, "This is you," by which they meant that everything around you, all the animals and plants and your fellow human beings, are, with you yourself, part of the breath of God. The priests had invented an extraordinary way of actually feeling this all-embracing unity. They would sit down somewhere in the depths of the ancient Indian forest and think about it and nothing else for hours, days, weeks, months, years. They sat on the ground, upright and still, their legs crossed and their eyes lowered. They breathed as little as possible, and they ate as little as possible. Indeed, some of them even tormented themselves in special ways to purify themselves and help them sense the divine breath within them. Holy men like these penitents and hermits were common in India 3,000 years ago, and there are still many there today. But one of them was different from all the others. He was a nobleman called Gotama, and he lived about 500 years before Christ. The story goes that Gotama, whom they were later to call the Enlightened One, the Buddha, grew up in eastern luxury and splendor. It is said that he had three palaces which he never left, one for summer, one for winter, and one for the rainy season, and that they were always filled with the most beautiful music. His father wouldn't allow him to leave their lofty terraces because he wanted to keep him far away from all the sorrows of the world. And no one who was sick or unhappy was ever allowed near him. However, one day Gotama summoned his carriage and went out. On the way he caught sight of a man bent with age, and he asked his driver what it was. The driver was forced to explain that this was an old man. Deep in thought, Gotama returned to his palace. On another occasion he saw someone who was sick. No one had ever told him about illness. Pondering even more deeply, he went home to his wife and his small son. The third time he went out, he saw a dead man. This time he didn't go home to his palace. Coming across a hermit in the road, he decided that he too would go into the wilderness, where he would meditate on the sufferings of this world which had been revealed to him in the forms of old age, sickness, and death. Later in his life, Gotama told the story of his decision in a sermon. And so it came about that, in the full freshness and enjoyment of my youth, in glowing health, my hair still black, and against the wishes of my weeping and imploring elders, I shaved my head and beard, dressed in coarse robes, and forsook the shelter of my home. For 6 years he led the life of a hermit and penitent. But his meditations were deeper and his sufferings greater than those of any other hermit. As he sat, he almost stopped breathing altogether, and endured the most terrible pains. He ate so little that he would often faint with weakness. And yet, in all those years he found no inner peace. For he didn't only reflect on the nature of the world and whether all things were really one. He thought about its sadness, of all the pain and suffering of mankind, of old age, sickness, and death, and no amount of penitence could help him there. And so gradually he began to eat again. His strength returned, and he breathed like other people. Other hermits who had formerly admired him now despised him, but he took no notice of them. Then, one night, as he sat beneath a fig tree in a beautiful clearing in a wood, understanding came. Suddenly he realized what he had been seeking all those years. It was as if an inner light had made everything clear. Now, as the Enlightened One, the Buddha, he went out to proclaim his discovery to all men. It wasn't long before he found like-minded people who were soon convinced that he had found a way out of human suffering. And because these followers admired the Buddha, they formed what we would call an order of monks and nuns. This order lived on after his death and still exists today in many Eastern countries. You can recognize its members by their yellow robes and their austere way of life. I imagine that you'd like to know exactly what happened to Gotama as he sat under that fig tree, the tree of enlightenment, as it became known, that took away his doubts and brought him inner peace. But if you want me to try and explain it, you will have to do some hard thinking, too. After all, Gotama spent 6 whole years thinking about this and nothing else. The idea that came to him, his great enlightenment, the solution to human suffering, was this. If we want to avoid suffering, we must start with ourselves, because all suffering comes from our own desires. Think of it like this. If you are sad because you can't have something you want, maybe a book or a toy, you can do one of two things. You can do your best to get it, or you can stop wanting it. Either way, if you succeed, you won't be sad anymore. This is what the Buddha taught. If we can stop ourselves wanting all the beautiful and pleasant things in life, and can learn to control our greed for happiness, comfort, recognition, and affection, we shan't feel sad any more when, as so often happens, we fail to get what we want. He who ceases to wish for anything ceases to feel sad. If the appetite goes, the pain goes with it. I can already hear you saying, "That's all very well, but people can't help wanting things." The Buddha thought otherwise. He said that it is possible to control our desires, but to do so we need to work on ourselves, perhaps even for years, so that in the end we only have the desires we want to have. In other words, we can become masters of ourselves in the same way that an elephant driver learns to control his elephant. A person's highest achievement on earth is to reach the point at which he or she no longer has any desires. This is the Buddha's inner calm, the blissful peace of someone who no longer has any wishes, someone who is kind to everyone and demands nothing. The Buddha also taught that a person who is master of all his wishes will no longer be reborn after his death. Only souls which cling to life are reborn, or so the Buddha's followers believe. He who no longer clings to life is released from the unending cycle of birth and death, and is at last freed from all suffering. Buddhists call this state nirvana. So this was the enlightenment that the Buddha experienced under the fig tree, the realization that, instead of giving in to our wishes, we can break free from them, rather like when we are feeling thirsty and take no notice, and the feeling goes away. You can see that the way to do this is far from easy. The Buddha called it the middle way, because it lay between useless self-torment and thoughtless pleasure-seeking. The important thing is to find the right balance, in what we believe, in the decisions we make, in what we say and what we do, in the way we live, in our ambitions, in our conscience and our innermost thoughts. That was the essential message of the Buddha's sermons. And these sermons made such a deep impression on people that many followed him and worshipped him as a god. Today there are almost as many Buddhists in the world as there are Christians, especially in Southeast Asia, in Sri Lanka, Tibet, China, and Japan. But not many of them are able to live their lives in accordance with the Buddha's teachings, and so achieve that inner calm. Chapter 11. The Great Teacher of a Great People. When I was a schoolboy, China was to us, as it were, at the other end of the world. At most we had seen the odd picture on a teacup or vase, so that we imagined a country of stiff little men with long plaits down their backs, and artful gardens full of humpbacked bridges and little turrets hung with tinkling bells. Of course there never was such a fairyland, although it is true that for more than 200 years, until 1912, Chinese men were made to wear their hair plaited in a pigtail, and that we first learnt about them through delicate objects of porcelain and ivory made by skilled craftsmen. From their palace in the capital, emperors had ruled over China for more than 1,000 years. The fabled emperors of China, who called themselves the Son of Heaven, just as the Egyptian pharaoh called himself Son of the Sun. But at the time I am going to talk about, around 2,500 years ago, all this was yet to come, though China was already a vast and ancient kingdom. In its fields many millions of hard-working peasants grew rice and other crops, while in the towns people strolled through the streets in sumptuous silken gowns. Over all these people a king ruled, and beneath him many princes who governed the many provinces of this immense country, which was larger than Egypt, and larger than Assyria and Babylonia put together. But soon these princes had become so mighty that the king could no longer command their obedience. They were constantly at war with each other, the big provinces gobbling up the smaller ones. And because the empire was so vast that in all its corners the Chinese spoke quite different languages, it would probably have fallen apart altogether had they not had one thing in common. This was their script. "But wait a minute," you say. "If they all spoke different languages, how could using the same script make any difference?" Well, Chinese writing is special. You can read and understand it even if you don't know a single word of the spoken language. That must be magic. No, absolutely not. It is really quite simple. Instead of writing words, you write things, If you want to write sun, you make a picture. Then you can read it in any language. Sun in English, soleil in French, ogi in Mandarin Chinese. Everyone who knows the sign will know what it means. Similarly with the sign for tree. Again, it is quite easy, just a couple of strokes. In Mandarin, it is pronounced mu, but you hardly need to know the sign to guess it is a tree. All right, you say. I can see that works quite well for things you can draw, but what if you want to write white? Do you just paint a blob of white paint? And what if you want to write east? You can hardly draw a picture of east. On the contrary, you'll see that it's all quite straightforward. We can write white by drawing something that is white, in this case a sunbeam. A stroke coming out of a sun stands for white. Blanc, pie, and so on. And east? East is where the sun rises, behind the trees. So I draw a picture of a sun behind a tree. That is clever, isn't it? Well, it is and it isn't. There are two sides to everything. For when you think how many words and things there are in the world, in Chinese each one has its own sign which must be learnt. There are already more than 40,000 of them, and some are really complicated and hard to learn. So I think we should congratulate our Phoenicians on their 26 letters, don't you? However, the Chinese have been writing like this for many thousands of years, and their signs are read in many parts of Asia, even where no Chinese is spoken. And this meant that the thoughts and principles of the great men of China were able to spread quickly and influence many people. Now, at the same time as the Buddha was seeking to relieve man's suffering in India, as you remember, that was around 500 BC, there was in China another great man who was also trying to make people happy through his teachings. And yet he was as different from the Buddha as he could possibly be. He wasn't a wealthy nobleman's son, but came from a family that had fallen on hard times. He didn't become a hermit, but an advisor and teacher. Rather than helping individuals not to want things, and therefore not to suffer, what mattered most to Confucius was that everybody should live peacefully together, parents with their children and rulers with their subjects. That was his goal, to teach the right way of living together. And he succeeded. Thanks to his teachings, all the peoples of China lived together for thousands of years, more contentedly and more peacefully than many other peoples of the world. So I am sure you will be interested in the teachings of Confucius, or Kung Fu Tzu, as he was called in Chinese. They aren't hard to understand, nor to remember. Perhaps that's why he was so successful. What Confucius proposed is quite simple. You may not like it, but there is more wisdom in it than first meets the eye. What he taught was this. Outward appearances are more important than we think. Bowing to our elders, letting others go through a door first, standing up to speak to a superior, and many other similar things for which they had more rules in China than we have. All such practices, so he believed, were not just a matter of chance. They meant something, or had done once, usually something beautiful. Which is why Confucius said, "I believe in antiquity, and I love it." By this he meant that he believed in the sound good sense of all the many thousand-year-old customs and habits, and he repeatedly urged his fellow countrymen to observe them. He thought that everything in life ran more smoothly if people did, almost by itself, as it were, without the need to think too hard about it. Of course, such behavior does not make people good, but it helps them stay good. For Confucius had a very good opinion of humanity. He said that all people were born honest and good, and that deep down they remained so. Anyone seeing a small child playing near the water's edge will worry lest it fall in, he said. Concern for our fellow human beings and sympathy for the misfortunes of others are inborn sentiments. All we need do is to make sure we do not lose them. And that, said Confucius, is why we have families. Someone who is always good to his parents, who obeys them and cares for them, and this comes naturally to us, will treat others in the same way, and will obey the laws of the state in the same way that he obeys his father. Thus, for Confucius, the family, with its brotherly and sisterly love and respect for parents, was the most important thing of all. He called it the root of humanity. However, he didn't mean that respect and obedience should be shown only by a subject to his ruler, and not the other way round as well. On the contrary, Confucius and his disciples often came up against obstinate princes, and would usually tell them exactly what they thought of them. For a prince must take the lead in observing the forms. He must demonstrate a father's love in providing for his people and deal with them justly. If he neglects to do so and brings suffering on his subjects, then it serves him right if they rise up and overthrow him. So taught Confucius and his followers. For a prince's first duty was to be an example to all who lived in his kingdom. It may seem to you that what Confucius taught was obvious, but that was exactly his intention. He wanted to teach something that everyone would find easy to grasp, because it was so just and fair. Then living together would become much easier. I have already told you that he succeeded, and, thanks to his teaching, that enormous empire with all its provinces was saved from falling apart. But you mustn't think that in China there weren't other people more like the Buddha, for whom what mattered was not living together and bowing to one another, but the great mysteries of the world. A wise man of this sort lived in China at about the same time as Confucius. His name was Lao Tzu. He is said to have been an official who became tired of the way people lived at court. So he gave up his job and wandered off into the lonely mountains at the frontier of China to be a hermit. A simple border guard at a frontier pass asked him to set down his thoughts in writing before leaving the world of men. And this Lao Tzu did. But whether the border guard could